Hello, you're listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Today, I am excited to be talking with cultural mythologist Jody Gentian Bauer, who worked as a science writer and editor for 3 decades, some of them in Port Townsend, where she moved in 1999 to take a job as a medical writer with Peter Gerloff's company Metaphor. She did have a chance conversation with the acquisitions editor of Quest Books, and that inspired her to start writing the book she'd been thinking about for years. Partway through her writing process, she decided to return to school and earn a PhD in mythological studies with a depth psychology emphasis from Pacifica Graduate Institute, which she completed in 2012 with a dissertation on recurrent motifs in women's narratives. She then spent a year rewriting that dissertation into the book we're going to discuss today, Jane Eyre's Sisters, How Women Live and Write the Heroine's Story. Jody, thank you so much for joining us today. And I would have to start with the question, what is a cultural mythologist?
Well, thank you for having me here today, Sheila. A cultural mythologist is a person who studies the underlying themes and myths that inform the culture. For example, the mythology behind our political ideology, our attitudes towards other countries, and our ideas about ourselves, who we are. For example, the mythology of the frontier is huge in American culture. There's always a frontier. We're always exploring it. We're always going beyond. That's just one example.
So how is that different than a cultural anthropologist, for instance?
Well, an anthropologist, I think, is studying human systems more than the underlying kind of assumptions or beliefs that are informing how people act and what they are aiming towards.
Okay. So I would imagine that at some point those things have to have an intersection.
We'll absolutely
get
yes.
back to that. According to your bio, you had a book idea, and it was so compelling that you quit your job and put yourself behind being a full-time writer. And then something happened, and you realized you wanted an education, a further education. So can you talk about the topic of what was to become your book, Jane Eyre's Sisters, and how that led you to the program and how the program then led you to be able to finish your book?
Okay, well, I didn't start out to do this at all. It came upon me. I was in a book club. We read a lot of books. We read a lot of books by women authors, mostly of the 20th century. And after a while, I just began to feel like I was reading the same book over and over again. Same plot, same essential characters. I actually got bored with it. I started referring to it as the standard feminist novel. But then I started realizing that the same pattern could be seen in earlier books. In the great 19th century books like Jane Eyre, Pride and Prejudice, Middlemarch. And then I started to notice that when I read a biography or autobiography of a famous woman, it was usually the same pattern. And this interested me, and I started looking for books that somebody had written about this, that other people must have noticed this pattern in women's literature. And I didn't find those books. I found books that wrote about the heroine's journey, but they were based on Joseph Campbell's heroic quest model, which is a masculine model, and it wasn't the same pattern at all. So eventually it occurred to me that if I wanted to read a book about this, I'd have to write it. As you mentioned, I had a chance meeting with Richard Smoley of Quest Books, and when I told him my idea, he said, we would be very interested in publishing such a book, which to me was the sign that I was to write the book. And like you say, I did quit my job, spent about a year trying to write it, and couldn't seem to make it happen. I got partway, and then I got stuck. I sent what I had to Richard. He said, no, this isn't good enough. And also, I had done the book proposal that you send in to publishers. And when it came to the section that said, well, basically, who are you to write this book? I kind of had nothing. You know, I was just the person who'd thought of it.
That's very good, though.
Yeah, but it wasn't like I had a lot of creative nonfiction under my belt at that point. I just had scientific and technical publications. So I had been dreaming of going to Pacifica and going through the myth program there.
Before you even began the writing? So what about that dream? Why did you dream about that?
Well, I was just so drawn to the program. Despite working in the sciences all my life, my undergraduate degree is in psychobiology, and I at one point discovered Carl Jung and that school of depth psychology, which fascinated me. And I do think that that school of psychology explains things better than the standard school. And I've always been drawn to this work. And the program is interdisciplinary. It's one-third mythology and world religions, which I've always had a strong interest in. One-third, basically, Western culture, mostly literature. And one-third, depth psychology. And so it attracted me, but I didn't really have a good enough excuse to put my life on hold and spend all that money. But because of the book, it was the thing that pushed me over and got me to apply.
That's excellent, because so many people get a PhD and then don't finish their dissertation, for instance. But you knew even then, I think, that your dissertation would become the book that you were dreaming of writing.
Yes, that was the plan.
And how does one have a chance encounter with a publisher?
It was synchronicity. If you're into Jung, you know what that means, that's not a coincidence. It's a meaningful coincidence. I was in California going to a workshop. He was one of the teachers. I had read a couple of his books. I did not know he was the acquisitions editor. I knew him as the author of these books. And so we got into a conversation about his books, quite a long conversation. At some point, I said, you know, I have this book idea.
Of you to bring that up.
Well, with one writer to another, people say it to me all the time. You know, I've got an idea for a book that's been rattling around in my brain. Because I didn't know he was who he was. If I had, I might not have said it. But he said, tell me about it. And I did. And then he said, we would be very interested. You know.
Well, that's an excellent sign. It's also an excellent grounding in the fact that your idea was clear and appreciated by somebody in the industry. So all I can say is you were very lucky. But I think a lot of writers can be lucky in that way. You put yourself in that place. You went to hear him speak. You knew his work. And the luck part may be that he was generous and willing to sit down and talk, and not some writers aren't in the mood when they're in public presentations. Then you were renewed in your energy to study, and then you wrote your dissertation, and then you had more time after you got your degree where you were still working on the book?
Well, I didn't want to do a scholarly book. You know, I didn't want to write a very academic book. I wanted to make it accessible to a wider audience than that. And that's actually what I've done all my life. I don't write for scientists. I write about science for lay people. It's my gift to take complicated topics and put them into simple language that anybody can understand. So that's what I wanted to do. And I wanted to make it more fun.
And it is fun. I've read it, and it's fun, and it's understandable, and I want to repeat the title. We're talking about Jane Eyre's Sisters, How Women Live and Write the Heroine's Story. We're talking with the author, Jodi Gentian Bauer. So Jodi, tell us the premise of the book then. You found that the pattern you were seeing in these novels wasn't really represented in the writing that you were finding about women and the heroine's journey.
Yeah, it was a pattern that was distinct, that repeated with variations through the centuries, basically reflecting women's lives at the time, but an essential pattern that just showed up over and over and again. And it's unique. As I said, it's not the traditional heroic quest model at all.
One thing you can tell us is, what is the traditional heroic quest model as the Joseph Campbell teachings, and what is the pattern you were seeing?
So the heroic quest model is that the young man is kind of a misfit, but he is called out from where he lives by some outside event. And you can be thinking of the King Arthur story or Luke Skywalker. George Lucas based that story on Joseph Campbell's book. He's called out by something or someone. He goes out, he has a lot of difficult trials, but at the end, he accomplishes a single wondrous thing, as fantasy author Sherry Tepper calls it. You know, he pulls the sword from the stone, he throws the ring into the fire, he kills the evil emperor. It's one thing that he has to do, and then he restores the safety or the integrity of his community, and he is welcomed back and usually made the king and usually gets to marry the princess. And it's a metaphor, you could say, for the journey to adulthood of a young man, where he has to go out into the world and grow up and get to the point where he is competent. And then he gets to be a father, and you know, he gets to get married, and he gets to be the head of the household. The heroine's journey that I saw is of a young woman who doesn't fit into her society, but everybody wants her to stay there, and they try to make her fit. They don't say, "You're a misfit, get out." They say, "Stop being different. Conform. Be who we want you to be." And at some point, this becomes too much for her. She's forced out. She's not called out. She leaves because she has to. And now you can be thinking about Jane Eyre and how many times she left. You know, she left her original home to go to school. She left the school to go to Thornfield Hall. She left Thornfield when she couldn't be with Rochester in the way that she would be comfortable with being. She wasn't going to be his mistress. And she again left the home of St. John Rivers when he was trying to make her be someone she didn't want to be. It's a constant series of leaving while she is trying to find the place where she can be who she is and really get in touch along the way with who she is, who she really is. And at some point, she achieves this, not through some single one act, but it's a process. It's, you know, much more about process. And she gets to the point where she is able to actually go back into the community, and whatever they say or do to try to make her conform, she's not going to do it anymore. And she's just secure enough, strong enough in herself. And then she finds her creativity. She starts to contribute. And often, even though she's not trying to do it, she has a wonderful transformative effect on those around her and on her community. So she doesn't, like the hero, preserve and save the community. She changes it, but she changes it simply by changing who she is and, really becoming who she is.
Thank you for that description. And I believe from reading the book that you have a name for her journey that's different than the heroine's journey.
Yeah, I'm struggling with terminology. So much of the terminology is inherited, you know, and I wanted to come up with a new word. I didn't like heroine because it's a diminutive of hero, and she's not really heroic in the traditional sense. So I came across a writing where this woman was using the word aletus, which is a Greek word, and it means wandering heroine, which was perfect.
So that's what you call this journey.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Well, I think you may have taken a little bit of this journey yourself, the whole journey perhaps. You're well into finding the creativity and making transformations in others who read your book and talk about this with you. And I think it's reflected in your name, perhaps, Jody Gentian Bauer. You've told me in days before our conversation here that that is a name that you've created from other sources and names. And maybe if by describing that, you would be describing some of your journey as well.
Sure. Yes, I was born Joanna Page Skinner, but for some reason, my first name was never used. I was always Jody. And I was married, and my marriage ended. And when my marriage ended, I really felt a strong need not only to lose my married name, but to lose my kind of my parental name, my father's name, too. So I went to Jody. I chose gentian because it's a flower that blooms very late in the fall. And I feel that I'm a late bloomer, too. And then Bauer honors my Scottish grandmother, who was a wonderful professional singer. And there's a tradition of singing that's come down in my family, and I sing myself. So I wanted to honor that, the feminine side of my heritage, and rename myself in midlife.
So you did that well before you decided to quit your job and start writing a book.
Yes.
But it was part of the journey, would you agree?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
You are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life on KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. Sheila's interview with author Jody Gentian Bauer continues.
This might be a good time to hear some excerpt from your book. I know that you told me you might read one that's about the process of writing.
Yes, I start out with a bit more theoretical stuff, I would say, before I get into some real examples. But I was impressed with just what writers do when they write stories. So I'd like to read a little bit about how writers change reality as it relates to this theme of my book. When writers write the elitist story, they imagine a new woman, a woman who, up until that moment, may not have even existed. Once she is created, she immediately becomes a role model for other women. Doris Lessing says that her masterpiece, The Golden Notebook, quote, was written as if the attitudes that had been created by the women's liberation movement already existed, end quote. But when she wrote the book, such attitudes were still to come. Lessing had to invent characters that could serve as role models to other women without having any such model herself. She used her imagination to create a new future for women, and when women read her book, they could imagine it too. The Golden Notebook was only one of many books that gave women of the 1960s ideas about a future they actually wanted, and so helped spur the women's liberation movement. For as soon as women had a vision of a possible future, they could work to create that future in real life.
Thank you. I have a question. Early in our discussion, you said that when you belong to the book group and were reading the same plot over and over again and you got bored, did all of this study and all of this understanding now of the process and how it changes women and therefore transforms people around them, is there still an element of boredom with this plot, or have you now decided that it's interesting?
No, I realized as I did the study that why I had trouble with books of my own generation, books written mostly in the 60s, 70s, 80s at that time, because it was in the 80s that I began to see this pattern. The problem was that most of those books were about getting a woman to a point where she realizes that she has to leave and leaving, but they didn't really know how to imagine into the future what happens next. I actually had to go to the biographies to see what happens next, because it was almost as if at that point in the baby boomer generation, and I think this is true of not just women, but the entire generation, there was kind of a feeling of, we don't want to do things the way they've been done in the past. We don't want to be like our parents. We're going to out everything. We're going to out the alcoholism. We're going to out the abuse. We're going to say no more. But it was, in a way, a bit adolescent. You know, it's we know what we want to reject. We don't know what we want to affirm. We don't know what that is, because we haven't had the role models. And I talk a lot in the book about how hard it has been for women to go into a future without a good role model. And the women's liberation movement and the women of the time, you know, especially in the 70s and 80s, were adopting a masculine model. I'm going to go into business. I'm going to be a lawyer. I'm going to be a doctor. I'm going to be a success materially. That turned out to not be actually what a lot of women did want, because there was something missing. So what we've been doing ever since then is trying to figure out, well, how do we pursue our own lives, not following the old female model where you're kind of passive and stay at home, or the masculine model where you have to be this hard-hitting, achieving person. We want something else. What is that? That's what we've been exploring. But if I looked at the lives of real women, that's where I found it, because these were the women who had managed that.
So do you think the literature's catching up?
Yes, I do think it is. And also, I think it's going beyond, because we're in a new generation where the children of these women that I just talked about, the next generation always goes a step beyond. And I look at my own nieces who are combining motherhood and career and creative life in a way that we only dreamed of, I think.
I think you're right. I'm interested to know if you have some genre, maybe. I know that you study popular culture as well as the novels of the past. Are you seeing this beyond, this life that the younger generation of women seem to be able to create now? Are you seeing it reflected in changes in plots or Do we get in our literature now, do we see the after the liberation to be your creative self? Do we start to see that person back in her community being who she is?
Well, yes, I do. And I do see it mostly in science fiction and fantasy, because these are always the people who are imagining a different future. And I like to call it speculative fiction, because they're basically saying, what if things were a little different? How would people be? It's not about robots and rockets for me. It's about a new vision of the future. And the best example, a perfect example of what I'm talking about, is Brenda Chapman's animated film Brave, where the princess doesn't want to be the passive prize for one of the new up-and-coming leaders to marry. And so she tries to circumvent that by winning the contest that the young men have to engage in for her hand. She wins it. It doesn't work. It throws the entire community in disarray, because nobody knows what's to happen next. And she doesn't know either. And she has to go off into the woods and meet the witch, which is what you have to do when you're an elitist. You have to spend time in the wilderness. You have to talk to the witch and learn from her. And she has to figure out her relationship with her mother. From all of that, she learns that there's a different kind of power. She learns her transformative power. She goes back into the community, into the hall where all the men are fighting, basically, and walks in with her head held high, and they all stop fighting and look at her, and she says, "I want to do things a different way." And all the young men say, "So do we." They don't want to buy into it any either. They just needed somebody to stand up and say, and this is another thing that I see happening in the elitist journey, that very often there's a man who follows her who says, "You know what? I don't want to conform either. I want to go live the life that I want to live." And because she shows him how to do it, then he can. So this is part of the transforming thing, too.
Thank you. So do you have any other references for us for the science fiction area where we might read more of this? And can you spell the term that you're using to describe the journey?
Elitist. Uh-huh. It's A-L-E-T-I-S. And an interesting thing is that I see the name Elitist or Elites being used in some science fiction now, because the authors have clued into this. But yes, if you really like fantasy, I would suggest the works of Terry Pratchett, who's a wonderful English writer, sadly suffering from early onset dementia now. But he has a wonderful series called The Weird Sisters, W-Y-R-D, Sisters, about a trio of witches. And he is wonderful about his women characters. They're not pretty. They're not necessarily young. He's very fond of old ladies. He's also very fond of young girls. And he has another part of the Weird Sisters series would be the Tiffany Aching series, which is the story of how a young girl becomes a witch. And he has daughters himself, and he gets girls.
Thank you. All right. We've increased our reading capacity and explore, hopefully for many of us, a new genre. Before we end today, I think you might be able to read a little bit more from your book and explain to us perhaps why you chose this excerpt.
Okay. Well, I think one of the most difficult trials that the elitist undergoes is not something like the hero that's outside the house. It's inside the house. She faces most of her trials at home before she leaves, because it's so hard to get to the point where she can say, "You know what? I can't be myself here. I got to go." And so there's a lot of refusing that she has to do. She has to refuse to get married to the guy that her father's picked for her. She has to refuse to conform to what her society is telling her should be her interests. And I'm just going to read this next section. "Perhaps the most difficult refusal for a woman is to refuse familial and societal obligations that require her to sacrifice herself to the needs of others. A woman in search of her authenticity almost inevitably will be called selfish by others. For example, in Miles Franklin's semi-autobiographical novel, My Brilliant Career, The heroine Sybilla's desire to pursue a writing career leads her mother to describe her as, quote, an abominably selfish creature who would not consider her little brothers and sisters. I would never be any good, as all I thought of was idleness and ease, end quote. When a girl's real job, according to others, is to take care of others, anything she chooses to do instead, no matter how difficult, will be seen as not just selfish but lazy. Sybilla also drew censure for refusing to marry. Franklin herself never did. She knew that marriage would bring a new set of obligations to her husband, to her eventual children, and in terms of all the duties expected of a wife. And I'll give another example here from a real life story, Jill Kerr Conway, who became the first woman president of Smith College. When Jill Kerr Conway made up her mind to leave Australia and pursue higher education in the United States, her hardest battle was with her guilt over leaving her widowed mother. Quote, I was haunted by my knowledge of the silence that would enfold the house when I left. I could see my mother, already aged beyond her years, becoming more stooped and skeletal as she forgot to eat and lapsed into greater eccentricity, she writes in The Road to Corain. Conway chose to bear this guilt as the price of having her own life. Now, it should be mentioned that she had two brothers who were still in the neighborhood who could
absolutely
take care of her mom.
It should be mentioned. I want to thank you for those readings and for this opening that we're having to a new way of understanding that I think that the stories we tell ourselves are really powerful. And by finding a story that we can relate to with a pattern that most feels like us, for instance, the desire to say no, to change our lives, to find our creativity, to use it and transform what we can, it's very powerful. And I can see how the cultural mythology is at work here. To loop back to what we began with. So now I want to be sure to let people know that by visiting Jody Bower, and that's JodyBower.com, you can find out more about her book, Jane Eyre's Sisters, How Women Live and Write the Heroine's Story, as well as events she'll be doing and lectures and teaching and what else is on your website for us.
I'm hoping at some point to put together a workshop based on this book. So that will be there too. But right now it's book readings, presentations that I'm giving at conferences, and I will be putting up basically anything that's related to the book.
Well, it's been wonderful to talk with you. I wish you lots of success with the book. It's an exciting venture. And I love thinking about how this was an idea that just needed to get out, and you did everything you could to make sure that you shaped it well, and now I know you're going to do everything you can to make sure that people hear about it and think about this journey in a new way. Thank you, Jody.
Thank you very much, Sheila.
You have been listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life with Sheila Bender. For more of Sheila's interviews, please go to Sheila's website, www.writingitreal.com/audio.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman. Production coordinator is Mike Schlexer.